San Diego.
I'm Richard. I'm an alcoholic. Happy to be here. Mildly happy. I'm mildly pleased to be here. I have to be totally honest. I was reminded before the meeting, so I'll try to be really honest. That might be tough for some of you, but not for me, not anymore. And I feel responsible to all of you, especially newer people, to tell you when I say I'm not Richard alcoholic, what I mean when I say alcoholic. And what I mean when I say I'm alcoholic is that my body physically cannot process alcohol like other people's. That's part of it. That's the easy part. So therefore, if I didn't take the first drink, I wouldn't really have a problem, right? Except for this. I have this problem right here. And this tells me that no matter what happened the night before, no matter if I wet my pants in public, if I beat you half to death, if I hit my wife, whatever, that this time, the next time I take a drink, it's going to be different. That's the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. That's me. I had that great obsession. I was obsessed with proving that I could drink not like a gentleman, but I really didn't ever want to be a gentleman, but that I could drink as much as I wanted to and be okay. And that never worked out for me. And I started really young. I was a child alcoholic. It took me a long time to admit that, but the reason I know that is because from the very, very first time I took the very, very first drink, I wanted another drink. And that's all I really wanted in life, is to drink after the first drink. I grew up in rural Montana. I grew up on a small, I called it a ranch. My dad thought it was a farm. I wanted to be a rancher, of course. You know, I was alcoholic right away, and I wanted to be a rancher, so I told everybody we lived on a ranch, but we didn't have a horse. So it was kind of hard to bullshit people about that when you really didn't have a horse. But if I didn't think they lived close enough to us, I'd tell you I was a rancher. My dad, we were farmers, you know. And I grew up 11 miles from the nearest paved road. I went to one-room country school for first 6 years, I guess, of grade school. Then we moved into town. And you know, I had my first drink harvest time on the farm. The men usually, you know, it doesn't get dark there till late. They cut wheat till, you know, when the crop's ready, you cut wheat. That's what you do. And there's just no stopping it. And when they do stop, they sit around the outside, wash up, and eat. Guys that have a beer, you know. And so I had a half can. My uncle left a half can of beer there because they would drink a half a beer or a beer and a half maybe, maximum, you know, before dinner. And it always bugged me, even when I wasn't drinking as a kid, that really bothered me that they didn't finish their drinks. So I, you know, of course had to help them out. And I remember the first time I had a half can of Hams beer, a half can. I was about 9 years old. And I'll tell you, all the little angst, because I was a little shit, to be honest with you. I was not a happy little guy. I was a handful of a kid. I was a fighter. I was a kicker, a screamer, a little shithead, you know. And my mother made sure I knew that on the end of her hand, you know. But I'll tell you, I changed when I had that first drink. I changed me right away. I mean, it took seconds for me to feel okay about myself. See, I wanted to be a man. I didn't want to be a kid. I wanted to be a man. I didn't want to have a childhood. I wanted to be a man. And I thought that if to be a man, you had to drink. You know, that's what men did after work. I didn't realize they had just worked 12 hours. You know, that's a different deal. You know, I mean, you don't think about that. It's just the beer afterwards I was after, you know. So we went broke farming, too, by the way. My dad went broke. It wasn't a big success story. And he had to take a job in town. He got a job with the Department of Agriculture in town, and we moved into town. And my first experience in town was we had a county sheriff. That was our law, and the county sheriff's word was like gold. When he said to jump, you jump. That was just about it in that county. And he happened to be my great uncle, which didn't really help. I thought it would, but it didn't help. And the first time I met him was he came to our house in town with his big black patrol car with the county sheriff symbol on it and invited me and my brother to sit in the front seat with him and told us that we couldn't steal any more wine from the old guy down the street. What a bummer, you know. We had this deal where, like kids, we had this deal setting up where this guy had his wine crock in the backyard, you know, bubbling wine, and we'd be siphoning it off into Coke bottles. We were the happiest guys in town, you know. That and his Lucky Strikes. And my great uncle made sure that we knew that if we stole any more wine from that guy, that he would tell our folks. And that was the worst punishment you could imagine at that point, you know. So I also learned how to fight then. After we moved into town, we hadn't fought much. There's nobody to really fight out there in the country. Our nearest neighbor's about 4 or 5 miles away, so I fought with my brother a lot, but that, you know, that's pretty normal stuff. And when we got to town, somebody would call us a dirt farmer, and that was reason enough to knock them on their ass, you know. So that's what we did. That's how I learned how to communicate. That was my best communication skill. If I didn't like what you said to me, I didn't use my words. They didn't have that slogan in grade school then, you know. You used your hands. So we started fighting. My brother and I started fighting all the town kids. And so that's how we made friends. And ironically, some of my friends today are those guys that I fought with in grade school. They're still, via Facebook, we're still buddies. You know, it's just amazing. And, I wasn't a very good student. I didn't pay attention very well. So far ahead, I thought I was behind, or I was so far behind, I thought I was ahead, and I didn't know the difference. So I had a hell of a time in school. I didn't know if I was ahead or behind. I didn't know if I was really smart or stupid. I just got the idea I was stupid somewhere. And then I started to flunk classes, and I was drinking all that time, you know. So that doesn't help in grade school either, being a little drunk. And your whole motive in life is to get another drink, you know. How are you going to pay attention? How are you going to do your homework? And my dad was a World War II vet. He was kind of distant, didn't have much to say unless it was some disciplinary thing. And we just kind of floated through school, you know, and did all the stuff he did. You know, I had my first little heartbreak, and that ended up in me punching this sheriff's nephew, a new sheriff. My great uncle had retired, and I punched the sheriff's nephew in the mouth and knocked his 3 front teeth out. And they came and arrested me in my sophomore high school class and took me away, you know. And that's the first time I ever realized that my behavior was going to cause problems. And that's when it started. And I got off with some probation or something for that, but I stayed at home and drank. I drank at home, you know, because there was always a bottle of whiskey around the house or something. My parents didn't drink at all. They would get 3 or 4 fifths of whiskey for Christmas, and they might crack 2 of them and pour one drink or something and have a little, you know, one of those little teeny drinks with some of that Christmas milky stuff in it, you know, and drink that. And then I would, like, we had a pantry, and the whiskey was up on the top shelf in the corner of the pantry. And I, as a kid, I'd have to stand on the counter to get it, you know. And I'd get up there, and I'd make a mark where the whiskey was before I moved the bottle, pour it into a squirt bottle, a glass squirt bottle, a squirt bottle full of whiskey, and put water in there to fill it back up to that mark. I was 10 or 12 years old doing that stuff. So that's childhood alcoholism. That's what that looks like. And the behavior problems, too. I was restless, irritable, and discontent. And who'd have thunk it? You know, my grandfather was a Russian immigrant. He had come here from Russia. They were what they called Volga Germans. He was from a German family who had homesteaded in Russia, basically. And the Bolsheviks tried to kill their families because they didn't want them owning land. And so they ran them out of Russia, and they came to the United States. And he was the patriarch of the family. And he drank vodka like it was Kool-Aid. Like it was like I would drink iced tea. He drank vodka just like that, glasses of vodka like this. For lunch, he would have a sandwich and a glass of vodka and go back to work. And he was restless, irritable, and discontent too, except when he was drinking. He was a really nice guy. And he was the disciplinarian in the whole family. He was in charge of the whole family, everybody. My dad was his son-in-law, and everybody did what he said. You know, that was it. So I grew up in this little kind of German-Russian subculture where the old guys drank vodka, and some guys didn't drink, and my grandfather was kind of ran the show. He liked me. I was a pretty good kid. I was a pretty good learner. And when he was drinking, he was a great teacher. He would show us how to sharpen jackknives, how to halter horses. You know, he had horses. He actually had a ranch, so he had horses. So we liked to go over there and play around with the horses and stuff. But when he told you to do something, like if he said run down to the barn and get a halter for this horse, he meant run, physically run to the barn. He would say no lollygagging. That meant get your butt down there and get back. So that's how I grew up with that kind of discipline. Which it doesn't matter to an alcoholic. You know, you can still drink. And even as a kid, you know, you got to start lying early, too, if you're an alcoholic. You have to lie to your mother right away because she's going to ask you, have you been drinking? You ever heard that before? Any of you know what that look, have you been drinking? And I could stand right up to her at 12 years old and go, no, you know, and then fall right over because I was so drunk. You know, and they don't want you to be alcoholic. They don't want you to be alcoholic. You know, she loved us. She didn't want us to be little drunk. She thought, well, they're going to grow out of it. He's going to grow out of it. My brother was an alcoholic. My sister didn't ever have a problem. And so, you know, I got through high school, and how I got through high school was the school board there. We had moved to a little bit bigger town, you know, an oil field boom town. So there was some drinking there, you know, drinking and weapons. And there were three factions in my little town. There were the farmers and ranchers, the oil people, and the people from town. And none of them agreed on how anything should be done. And so they settled that stuff with violence, basically. That's how they all got settled. And when I was a kid in high school, if you wore your hard hat from work into a bar, they'd serve you. It was if they figured if you could work, you could drink. And I did. Boy, I drank a lot. And it was about 1968. I was going to graduate from high school. Well, graduate's a loose term about how it worked. They didn't want to pay the school board. They really didn't want to pay for an extra year for you, you know. So they just kind of shoved you out the door with a diploma. That's a high school graduation there, you know. And a lot of kids did really well. I tried to do really well. I just couldn't focus. I just could never focus. I mean, I loved some of my classes. I really liked math class, but I just couldn't do the homework, you know. I just loved it. And that'll come back later, you know. All these little gifts come back after we're sober a while. But what happened next for me was I was going to get drafted, and I was in a new county, and that meant that my draft number was way up there at the very front of the line because I didn't have anybody to get me out of it, you know. And at that time, you had to have somebody to get you out of the draft if you weren't going to get drafted. And so I was going to get drafted, and I had a big idea. You know, alcoholics have big ideas. You ever notice that? Big, I mean, not little ideas, big, grandiose ideas. You're going to take over the whole world. You know, megalomaniac type ideas. My big idea that day was I was driving I had a 1950 Ford. Was my first car. I paid $125 for it. I worked and earned the money and paid for it. And I was driving past the post office, and I noticed the Navy recruiter car there. And this light bulb just went off. The big idea came, you know. My way out of the draft came. I'll join the Navy. And I'll get out. See, they're drafting people into the Marine Corps. I thought that would be like hell. So I just joined the Navy. Well, here's how smart I am. So I joined the Navy. I go to Great Lakes for boot camp. I'd never been on a plane in my whole life before then. I was a country boy. I'd never been on a plane. I went to boot camp all alone. We went on individual orders then. No groups, nothing. I went by myself to Great Lakes. And get out of boot camp. And I really didn't understand that you would have to have a job in the Navy. You know? I thought you got your sailor suit, you know, and it looked good, learned how to fold it up and everything, and we drank, you know. And then all of a sudden, one day in boot camp, they assigned us a rate, you know, this thing called a rate, which is going to be your job, you know. And we had taken all these tests, and hell, I was in boot camp for a while. I was sober for 3 weeks at least, you know. And so I did fairly well on all their little tests, you know, the little intelligence tests and all that stuff. I did really well on those tests. And so this guy calls me over to his desk, and I go over to sit down, and I go, you know, I'd like to be a blah, blah, blah. I had some idea what I should be. I had another big idea, you know. And he goes, we need corpsman. You're going to be a Navy hospital corpsman. And so I go, okay, you know, and I went to hospital corps school, and that was kind of interesting, and we learned all kinds of stuff and how to give shots and I start IVs, and we did all kinds of stuff. In about 6-7 weeks, we learned all that stuff. And we studied from really early in the morning till late at night and marched around and did all kinds of stuff, and I was a pretty good little sailor, you know. And right after corps school was over, I got orders, and my orders were to guess where? Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. And I asked the chief, I go, Chief, what the hell is this? I'm supposed to be in the Navy. He says, not anymore. You're going to be a Marine. You're going to be with the Marines the whole rest of your time. And so I got sent to Camp Lejeune, and I got a Marine Corps uniform. And I wore a Marine Corps uniform with Navy stripes on it for the rest of the time, the whole time. And then they sent me to this operating room tech school in Bethesda, Maryland. And about 2 hours after I graduated from that school, this guy caught me in the hallway, and he's waving this paper. He says, I was a third class, I think. He goes, Zinny, here's your orders. And I go, what? I mean, this is kind of quick. The ink hadn't even dried on my little fake diploma yet, you know. And the orders were to NSA Da Nang, and Naval Support Activity Da Nang. And I was like just about to enter a world that's just unbelievable for a guy, a little country boy with no experience. And I had all this training and had done pretty well in my trading. I paid attention. I was sober most of the time during that. I would drink a lot at night and stuff, you know, but I was able to stay sober because you're young. You can handle it, you know. You can drink half a case of beer and go to bed and wake up in the morning and still go to work when you're, you know, 19 or 20. You can do it then, you know, but things kind of wear out after a while, you know. And so I got to Naval Support Activity Da Nang. I was an ORA tech, so I worked in the triage area, and I also... Because I was a Marine Corps corpsman. I wasn't a Navy corpsman anymore. I belonged to some commanding officer of the Marine Corps Air Wing there. And the reason I did was because they did the medevac stuff. So I became a medevac corpsman. I flew hundreds of hours of medevacs for 18 months. I didn't leave there for 18 months. And I landed at the air pad out in front of NSA Da Nang thousands of times. I couldn't even count the times. I worked in the... triage unit. I was 19 years old. My first casualty that I got in the helicopter, I puked on. It was so bad. I've never seen anything so horrible in my whole life. It's unbelievable what happens to human beings. And so you create your own little world. There might be some combat people in here. You create your own little world in those situations where you just, we had our own money. You know, we had script. We had, we went to downtown Da Nang to the, we had go-kart races. We had what we called the steam and cream. You can only imagine what that might be, a massage parlor and, you know, other activities happened there. We did a lot of that. And we drank and fought, too. So I fit right in at the Marine Corps because we drank and fought, you know. And so, I was good at this, you know. And what was happening, and I didn't know at the time, but what was happening is after the first time I vomited on somebody, the casualties just kept coming, you know, and you have to do your job. You have to be there. You have to show up. You have to do your job. And so what happened, and unbeknownst to me, is I was pushing down all this little experience into my psyche, really stuffing it in there, just jamming it in. And nobody to talk to. They didn't debrief us when we came back. We landed up here at March Air Force Base and after about 18 months and got on the bus. And the hippies were out there then. We had hippies, man, they were everywhere. And they were throwing shit at our bus, calling us baby killers, you know. And I wanted off that bus so bad, we wanted to kill really bad then, you know. And that's when I got my hippie hate. That's where that came from. I became a hippie hater. And I still might have a mild case of it, but not like that. You know, we hated hippies. We hunted hippies. We had a grudge, you know. Shit, you have a grudge. Anyway, I drank. You know, I drank, and finally I got stationed at Camp Pendleton. We were too rowdy for the people out of 29 Palms, so they sent us to a bunch of us to Camp Pendleton, and just to get us off the commanding general's list, you know, and sent us to, and I did really well. I had a whole chest full of medals and good, you know, I was a good boy. I was a good Marine because we fought and drank. They liked that. You know, that's what you're supposed to do. And then, you know, I had an opportunity to have the Navy send me to college. That wasn't good enough for me. I just went I was going to go my own way, you know. And so I got discharged from Camp Pendleton. One of the happiest days of my life. I don't even know why. It was a huge mistake, but for me, but. And, you know, I didn't have the support of the military to support my drinking, the enabling, all that stuff, all the Dexamil spanchels we took, all that stuff to help me be a better drunk. We're gone, you know. I became a common street drunk within months after that. A bumbling idiot hanger-runner in bars. And I started going to school on the GI Bill, which was nothing compared to what it is today. We had $460 a month, so I had to have a job to go to school, and I had a job. Got my GI Bill and went to college and drank with the other veterans. We just drank. We just hung around the bars and drank. And one of the reasons I drank was because I'd be sitting in U.S. history class or some fundamental class, and my mind wouldn't be there, and I would be where I was 8 months ago, you know, vomiting on people in the back of the helicopter or whatever, you know. And so I didn't know you could get help, and I was afraid to tell anybody that I had that going on. And I sure as hell wasn't going to tell you I couldn't stop drinking. And I actually started to know that I couldn't stop drinking then. I started to know it before I ever got discharged from the military. I remember getting stationed at 29 Palms and seeing my mind. I could see my mind figure out where I was going to get my drink that day, what I was going to do that day to lie to go get a drink so I wouldn't have to have duty that night so I could drink. I could see my mind do it. Man, that's easy at that age to push that aside and go, oh, shit, you're just a, You know, they'd all say, if I passed out in the barracks or something, the other guys would pick me up and go, "You'll be better when you get out of the service. It'll go away." You know, it does. Alcoholism doesn't go away, by the way. Once my body is like that, it's just like that. You know, I have a disease. I have alcoholism, and so I went from one bar to another, basically a kind of a hanger-on or wet your pants in public kind of guy. I was a wet your pants in public drunk when I was in my early 20s, and I came back to San Diego. I thought, these people don't know what the hell. You know, you start going, oh, they don't know what the hell they're doing here. I'm leaving. I'm going back to California. So I had an old Ford Bronco, and about the back end of my Ford Bronco was my stuff. You know, it was a suitcase or something. And I just drove back down here, and, you know, I had to sell the Ford Bronco for rent or something. And I finally wound up living in the alley over between 45th and Shimon by myself, hating you. It didn't matter really who you were either. I could figure out a way to hate you pretty quick. And I drank as much as I could. I drank in the Rackham Up, the Cuckoo Club, and the Tower, and all the really cool places there on University Avenue where the really happening people went, you know. And I learned later that you couldn't be the coolest guy in the bar with a big wet spot in your pants. It's hard, you know, the girls aren't really attracted to that. It's kind of interesting. You know, it just doesn't work out. And So I drank and fought there, too. I did that, too. We went to the Rackham Up and the Neutral Ground and, you know, beat each other up with pool cues and stuff. And I did that for about 4 years. I lived in that alley for about 4 years like that. And I lived in the alley. I had a little pickup for a while after that, and I lost that a couple times, and I got it back. And, you know, these people let me stay in their garage, and I lived in there for a while. And at the end, what was happening to me was that a typical day for me at the end was this. I would be drinking all day. And then I would pass out on the cement floor there, the garage or whatever, and I would smell something burning that would wake me up. I'd smell fire. I'd go, "Oh, my God, this place is burning down." I'd wake up just nuts, you know. And I'd start crawling around on my hands and knees looking for the fire. And I'd find like a half can of beer with some cigarette butts in it because I used that as an ashtray. And, you got to have a drink when you got to have a drink. So I would just strain the butts through my teeth and drink, you know. That's alcoholism. That's what happens, you know. And one night, for some reason, I had a little, what they call a moment of clarity, which is turns out to be an incredible gift in my case. And what happened was the moment of clarity is I could see who I really was. I could see the truth for just a few seconds about myself. Maybe a few seconds, seemed like forever. I got to agonize over what Richard really was like. What a lying, cheating, little scummy guy I was. I had a red beard down to about here. My hair was over my ears. I was just nuts, you know, and I would just glare at you in the grocery store until you got out of my way, you know. And, I didn't go in the grocery store much except to get, you know, vodka. Free. It was always free, of course, you know. There's a lot of free vodka in the Vons, you know. At that time, it was Lucky Foods. I stole a lot of their cheap vodka, big bottles. They didn't have plastic bottles then, but so after my little moment of clarity, I didn't know. I didn't have any more big ideas. I didn't have another plan. I didn't have a way out. I didn't have not have a way out. And I remembered, and I was raised as a Catholic, and I went to catechism in the summertime. We had 2 weeks of catechism in the summertime because we didn't have a Catholic school. We hated that. You know, because they screwed our summer up, you know. And I had gotten caught on the playground smoking a cigar butt with a Protestant kid. And then the Catholic nun, Sister Mary something, you always had two names. She took me in, you know, back in the classroom. And I don't know if she was really pissed about the Protestant kid or the cigar butt. But one of those two things, did it. And so she said, "I want to teach you how to pray because you have a bunch of penance to do. You know, you're going to get on your knees here and pray." And she says, "Richard, for you, you're going to need this later in life. I'm going to teach you this prayer. It's a very simple prayer, and it'll work for you. And she said this, "if you mean it." And she said, "the prayer is, God help me." And so that night in my little alley over here, I remembered that nun telling me that. So I got on my knees, and I did exactly what she said, and I meant it. I damn well meant it that time. I said, "God help me. I have not had a drink since that second, or a drug, since that second." And that was October 1st, 1978. The next day, somehow, I got to a meeting. I don't even remember going to the meeting. I remember being in the meeting, and I was bored shitless. And you know, it wasn't exciting in there. They were talking about themselves, and they were saying things. I just couldn't believe these people had 3 years or something, you know. 3 years of not drinking. What do you do at Thanksgiving? You know, I mean, that was the question in my mind. What about the 4th of July, for Christ's sake? What are you going to do then? You know, how are you going to have fun? What do you do at parties? What about basketball games? Don't you drink before that? You know, I mean, I just had this, my mind was just racing with all these things. What are you going to do? What are you going to do? What are you going to do? And I didn't have any answers. And the next thing that happened, and so God had, I didn't know it, but when I asked God for help, God actually answered. He actually had taken charge of the deal. And so little crumbs came to me after that. The first little crumb was, I'm a bolter too. I will bolt after a meeting today. I'll bolt for the door and just, I'm don't like the crowd. You know, so I'll run for the door. And I did. I ran for the door. And right at the bottom of the steps was this guy, in a kind of a chubby guy in a white T-shirt. And he had these crystal clear blue eyes. And I swear to God, he could see in the back of my head. He could tell exactly what I was thinking. And I was bolting and never coming back. And you know what that son of a gun said to me? He says, I'll see you tomorrow. That's all it took. See, I was that fickle. You could say, you know, you could have said, never come back, and I wouldn't have. All he did was say, I'll see you tomorrow. It's the best 12-step job anybody ever did on me. And believe me, lots of really good Al-Anons tried. I had a couple wives in there, too. Lots of Al-Anons tried to save my butt. Man, I love to be saved, you know. See, human aid to me, God helping me is one thing. If you help me, it means money to me, $50 at least. Nowadays, it'd be $100, you know, the price of booze. Christ, you got to have at least $100. You know, and I'd lie about paying the rent or something. You know, I need to pay the rent. I forgot to pay the rent. God, I'm in trouble. You know, can I get $50? And then I'd be drunk again. Then I'd come back next week. Oh, God, my rent's due. I didn't have any rent, for Christ's sake, you know. And I'd tell another lie. And I'd just pile them up and pile them up and pile them up. And then the next thing that happened, I didn't trust anybody. I didn't trust men or women. I didn't trust anybody. I didn't get a sponsor. I didn't do any of that crap. God had gotten me sober. I'd never seen the big book. I had probably been to meetings before. I don't really remember where, but I probably had been to meetings before. I didn't have a big book. I didn't know what they were doing in there, and I was there sober. I was there without the obsession, had been removed, just like that. And that's what we talk about in our literature. It talks about asking God to do that. Because, see, my obsession is intertwined with any kind of sound reasoning I have left. That's the problem with this disease. The mental part of it is really dangerous because you might be just a great thinker. You could be a mathematician or the greatest scholar on earth and still just be a drunk because you can't figure this out with your mind. It's not a mind thing. We have a spiritual solution for this. That's why. Because you can't think your way out of this. You're never going to think your way out of it. If you're really alcoholic like I am, you're doomed. It says that in our literature. I was doomed. And I didn't even know that. I had never read the big book. You know, and so they were in their meetings talking away, and I sat over in the corner, and I could hear this radio station playing on the wall. And so I just focused on that, you know. And I sat there for a long time, and then the next thing that happened is one day, somebody had the courage to ask, and I glared at people too, because I hated you, you know. And somebody asked me to read how it works. And I thought there was some sort of con job going on in AA. I thought it was like an Amway thing or one of those pyramid scheme deals where you put your money in the basket. And I knew that guy that took the money at the front desk was making out on us, you know. He wanted something from me. Here I came from an alley, and I thought, I was so self-centered, I thought this guy wanted something from me. Think about that. How crazy that is to think that somebody in AA wanted something from me. They wanted to help me. They needed me, and I didn't know it. You know, like, I need you. I'm here tonight because I need you. That's why I came here. I'm here to save my own ass. You know, I need newcomers in my life. I need other alcoholics in my life constantly. I need you. I'm not kidding. I need you to survive. And you need me, too, if you're alcoholic. Isn't that sad? Think that over on your ride home, you know. That'll keep them coming back, huh? Guy like that, I need him like hell I do. Do you hear what that guy said in there? Hell no, I don't need you. Yes, you do. Or somebody like me, pretty close to me. Anyway, so I looked down at this sheet in front of me, and doggone, you know what it said right on the top line? It said, how it works. I couldn't believe it. They had written it down. I mean, they wrote down... They actually wrote down the answer. They're giving it away. Then I'm really suspicious. I think, what the hell is this about? You know, they're giving this away. I can just do this and stay sober. You're kidding. This guy asked the guy in the t-shirt then. I said, I can just do this and stay sober. He says, yeah, just get one of those books and start reading it. I'm a great reader. Oh, by the way, when I was in grade school, my little country school, an eighth grade girl taught me how to read. When I was in the seventh grade, they couldn't test my reading comprehension. It was so high. But I was a drunk. See, it doesn't matter how smart you are or how dumb you are or what college you went to or what job you had or who your mother and dad were. You're alcoholic. Your mind doesn't know that. It's just like this disease. It's just wrapped around your thinking. You know, and you can't, it takes a spiritual solution to get to sustain any kind of God interceding in that. You know, and I didn't know that when I came here either. Now, I wasn't really afraid of God. I had just kind of given up on the God idea. Like, what do you need God for? You know, really. I mean, come on. I prayed a lot in the back of the helicopter, though, by the way. I prayed a lot. And I also listened to some really weird music, 60s music on our headphones, you know. So it was a kind of a weird, surreal deal. The whole thing still is to me. I don't have very many memories of it. I have gone to a lot of therapy to get over some of it. The people can know who we are, can help us today. And so I've done all that stuff to try to maintain my sobriety, basically, you know. And then, so the next thing was, this guy tells me about the big book. And he says, that's in the big book. That's one of the chapters from the big book. So I get a copy of the big book. At that time, they just said, you know, just steal this one shit. We don't care. You know, that's what we're supposed to do. If we're supposed to give this away. You know what I mean? Nobody charged me for it. I didn't have any money anyway, so I thought I was really getting over on them. I took one of their big books, you know. Boy, how tricky is that? You know, I got one of your big books. Ha ha! You know? I'm taking it home, too. I'm going to read it tonight and not tell you, you know. And I sure as hell wouldn't let you know I was reading that, you know. So I start reading the big book, and doggone, I thought, I'm self-centered. You know, my main problem is I'm self-centered. When I'm reading the big book the first time, I thought it was a trick. I really thought they wrote it just for me. That's how selfish I am. Screw you guys. They wrote that thing for me. You know, you can do whatever you want. It's about me. It's about Richard, you know. And so I started reading the big book, and I read along, and I figured out, I was pretty good at English in high school, and I figured out that the verbs meant that they did some action. That was kind of scary. So I would read along till I found a verb, and then I would try to do that verb, you know. When I got reading through the big book to the third step, when it said you need to find somebody else to do this prayer with, that's when I found a guy that I called a sponsor at the time. And we took the third step together in the front seat of his Volkswagen that he drove to meetings in. He's gone now, but that's what we did. We took the third step together. Oh, the other thing was that just astounded me. So I was raised a Catholic, you know, and so in the first couple meetings, they held hands to say the Lord's Prayer after the meeting. You know, I grew up Catholic in church. We didn't, you know, you weren't even allowed to touch yourself in the Catholic Church, let alone hold hands with another guy, for Christ's sakes. What are they thinking? You know, that made me irritable. You know, that irritated the crap out of me, that holding hands things after meetings. Wow. And some of those guys put their arms around each other. I grew up on a ranch in Montana. We didn't do that, you know. We had some weird cattle that did that, but, you know. So, anyway, the next thing that happened was that I remember very little about my first two or three years. Very, very little about it. But I do remember sitting on the couch at this facility where I went to meetings. I went to this 1 o'clock meeting, which is the sickest meeting in AA. I went there every day religiously. I went there every day because that guy was there. And he lived in a milk truck. That's how far he had come, you know. He was living in his milk truck, and he was my spiritual advisor, and I didn't even know it, you know. I didn't even know that's what was going on. That's what had happened. It just happened to me, and I didn't figure that out, you know. Here I am sitting in this guy's milk truck talking to him about God, for crying out loud. How could my life come down to that, you know? Jesus, I just felt pathetic, you know. And I'm asking him, when am I going to get a job? And he says, when God wants you to. And I think, what an idiot. You know, I wouldn't say that, but I think that to myself. I go, how can he think that, you know? I need to get out there and get a job. He says, you need to go to another meeting. And then he'd say, where are you going to your next meeting at? He says, when you leave this meeting, you better have a plan for the next one. When I leave this meeting tonight, guess what? I have a plan for the next meeting. I know exactly where my next meeting is after this one. I have my whole sobriety, 35 years of it. I have always had another meeting to go to. I have a plan. My plan is to get my butt to another meeting. That's what I do. And if you don't have time for that, I've been important too. I became important. You know, sober, you get to be important for a while until you realize you're important, you know, and then that's over. And then, thank you. Anyway, So I continued to take the steps. I would read along in there, and then I would call this guy, my guy who I called a sponsor. He wasn't the guy in the milk truck. The guy in the milk truck really was, but he would never say that. And this other guy from my men's meeting I went to on Friday nights, I called him my sponsor. So I would he allowed me to call him once a week on Sunday night after his golf game. Because he said he didn't really think I was going to make it, and he didn't want to bother me. He didn't want me to bother him. I'm deadly serious. He says, if you're not willing, he didn't read the big book to me. He didn't bring his diaper bag over to the alley and change my diapers. He says, you're a big boy. You get in this book and do what it says. You're going to grow up now. You know, and I had done a lot of man things in my life, and I was just like a child to this guy. You know, alcohol had made me into a kind of a really sick little boy again, you know. So I took direction. I was used to that kind of really kind of tough direction. That's what worked for me. Now, if that doesn't work for you, there's people here who, you know, put their arm around you and tell you, keep coming back, honey, and all that stuff. And that'll if that's what you need, that's what God will get you. See, God got me what I needed, not what you needed. And then I remember telling the guy in the milk truck one time, I told him I had a problem with envy. Well, we got to the fourth step, and the sponsor guy, I said, I'm ready to take the fourth step. And he says, do you know what a resentment is? And he would always say, he'd ask me a question, and he'd say, right away, he'd say, don't lie to me. Like, really quick. Like, he knew I was going to lie no matter what he asked, you know. So he said, we need to write a list of resentments. He says, do you know what a resentment is? And then he says, don't lie. And I go, I don't think so. And he goes, do you have a grudge? Well, hey, I had lived to get even my whole life. I had lived to get even. That was my whole goal in life, to get even with you. You bastards, whoever you were, you know. Anybody could stand up and I go, it's your fault, you know. God, I had the military, I had grade school, I had teachers in high school, I had my grandfather, I had my mother and dad, I had everybody to get even with. I was going to get even. That's a grudge. That's what we call resentments in AA. And so I made a list of resentments. I read them off to him. I didn't do a very good job on the first time. You know, I did my best. It was good enough for God, obviously, or I wouldn't be here, right? See, you don't have to. This doesn't have to be good enough for anybody but God. You know, it's who we're working for, right? And so that's who I work for. And so I did my best in the steps, which were, when I look back, it was newcomerish. Which I was a newcomer. That's what you do, you know. And I can write an inventory now in about 20 seconds if I'm hurting enough. Sometimes I even write them before I get in pain. It's amazing, isn't it? So I'll tell you another little story and then I'll shut up. But I didn't have a job when I got sober. I didn't have any prospects of getting a job. I painted some houses. I started painting houses. My grandfather had taught me how to paint. And man, he taught you how to paint every little dab, you know what I mean? It was meticulous painting. So I was a pretty good painter. So I painted houses. I had this little pickup back, and I had a ladder on top. The ladder would turn the other way when I turned the pickup. You know, I didn't have a rack. And, you know, it was just here I was driving around painting. I had a house to paint once in a while. And I still wanted to go to school. You know, I wanted to go to school. And I was going to some meetings at noon at the Grove at Lemon Grove, which is even sicker than the meetings I started out in. And And there was this cute blonde girl there one day, you know, and I thought, you know, I probably could help her out, so we should have lunch. And, you know, and so I asked her to go to lunch, and we went to lunch, and she does that really, really smart, dumb blonde thing, you know, how the women kind of use us guys. They're, you know, really slick about it, and I was like, I was being aware of that, you know, and all of a sudden she says, what do you do? And I said, well, I'm going to college. And she said, what are you studying? And I said, geography. You know, I love maps, so I was trying to be a geographer, a cartographer. And she says, she says, "What's that? What's geography? What is that?" And I thought I told her what it was. I really didn't know at the time. I didn't know shit. You know, I just babbled something out of the textbook at her, and she goes, "God, you got to come up to where I work. That's what they do where I work. They're looking for people. This girl from the sickest meeting in the world, you know, is God's will. See, God's got me by the lust and pride. And when God wants to move you, your character defects are like handles. You know, you get moved around. Here, we're going to move you over here with your pride. Here, we're going to take your lust, and it's just a hook, and we're going to move you with that." So he had lust and pride, you know. And so I went up there and got this $5.50 an hour job. Yeah, it was big. I was in my mid-30s. And I'll tell you what happened. That was a startup company. I didn't even know what that meant, you know. And I went up there. They had maps everywhere. I was in map heaven. This was an unbelievable place. I thought I had gone to heaven for $5.50 an hour. I was in this map world. It was unbelievable how good I felt about being at work. I had never felt like that about anything. And that company became successful. And I became a vice president 10 years later. And I prayed every day, all day long at work, every day. What should I do now? What should I do now? What should I do now? And the answer I got every time was, I'd go to my little guy in the milk truck with a resentment list. He'd go, "You get your ass back up there and be of service to those people, because you're an AA and they're going to find out. And I don't want you to make us look bad." He's living in his milk truck. Doesn't want me to make him look bad, you know. So that's kind of how I've been led down the path in AA. And if you surrender your will, I surrendered my will that night in the alley. If you surrender your will, this or something like that will happen for you, your version of this. See, I had a big envy problem. I was always envious of all the people in AA who had the big cars and the girlfriend and all that stuff. Right away, they'd get this stuff, you know. And my guy in the milk truck would go, "Just hang on. He says, you have the Richard spot. God gave you Richard. You're Richard. You don't get to be the Bill guy or the whatever. You get to be yourself. That's your gift." I didn't believe I was a gift, see. I didn't believe that then. It took me years of sobriety to believe that I was even smart. My sponsor tricked me into saying it one day. Had to trick me. He says, "At that startup company where you're a big shot, do they hire stupid people?" And I go, "No." He goes, "What are you doing there?" See? How about that? "What are you doing there?" And I wasn't stupid. See, I had beat myself down really bad. And if you have and you're here tonight and you can't stop drinking, this is the first step, you know. Just concede to your innermost self that you're really alcoholic and join us on the road to what we call happy destiny. Yeah. And I hope some of you do. Thank you.